The news headlines for this hour, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation calls on the UN to appoint a special envoy on Islamophobia. Iran and Syria call for the immediate withdrawal of American and other illegitimate foreign forces from Syrian soil. And Moscow says there can be no peaceful settlement in Ukraine as long as Kiev serves as a tool in the West of war against Russia. Thank you for joining us. In today's top story, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation has held an extraordinary session to address the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark. In a resolution released following the virtual meeting, the OIC strongly condemned the recent despicable acts of aggression against the Muslims' holy book. It also called on the UN Secretary General to appoint a special rapporteur on combating Islamophobia. The OIC urged member states to take appropriate action, whether political or economic, in countries allowing the sacrilegious acts. In the meeting, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said that governments or Islamic governments should reaffirm that burning the Quran is a clear example of racism and should be criminalized. The Holy Quran has been desecrated in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, once again despite growing outrage across the Muslim world. Two men named Salwan Mamika and Salwan Najem burnt pages of the Holy Book in front of the Swedish Parliament. The police had granted the permit in advance. Mamika has carried out the same actions twice before in the past 40 days outside Stockholm's main mosque and later outside Iraq's embassy. Both incidents led to outrage and condemnations worldwide. Meanwhile, Denmark has reacted to a similar sacrilegious act that recently happened in the country. On Sunday, the Danish Foreign Ministry said it is exploring legal means to stop the desecration of holy books. The Swedish Prime Minister also said a similar process was already underway in his country. An Iraqi woman who went viral on social media attempting to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Qudsa Samarai says she suffered injuries during the confrontation with two far-right activists and was later arrested on theft charges. Robert Carter has travelled to Denmark to meet with Al-Samarai and filed this report.
The Arab woman who took on two far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the two men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out. And then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay. So it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Quds now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident, which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago. That doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defense of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Iran and Serbia are forging ahead in bolstering their bilateral relations as the Syrian foreign minister meets with his Iranian counterpart in the capital, Tehran. Here's a report.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian welcomed his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Mehrdad in Tehran on Monday. The visit is aimed at boosting bilateral ties at various regional and international levels. It follows a historic trip by the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to the Arab state back in May.
One of our common priorities is to follow up on the agreements between the presidents of the two countries during the recent visit of Dr. Raisi to Damascus. In the past weeks, with the efforts of the ambassadors of the two countries, we have seen progress in the implementation of economic, commercial, and technological agreements between the two countries.
The two diplomats also explored avenues for advancing commercial and economic collaboration. Both Tehran and Damascus are actively pursuing de-dollarization in their trade transactions, aiming to reduce reliance on the greenback.
We've agreed that business transactions between Iran and Syria will be done with the national currency of the two countries.
Countering destabilizing elements in the region, notably the Zionist regime, was another line of discussion. The Syrian foreign minister emphasized the destructive impact of the Israeli regime, reflecting the sides' joint commitment to addressing such challenges.
What we are witnessing today in the Zionist entity and regime, the depth of the crisis, that it is an illegitimate regime. Its main objective is occupation and the building of settlements at the expense of lands of others. The indigenous people of this land, the land of Palestine, or the people of Palestine.
During their bilateral dialogue, the focus also centered on the contentious issue of the illegal U.S. military presence in Syria, widely perceived as a primary catalyst for regional terrorism.
Iran and Syria are two longtime allies whose joint record in the fight against terrorism in the region has been significant at the global level. The relations between the two countries can be improved to an important level by removing economic and commercial obstacles. Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
A ceasefire has been reached between Palestinian Fatah Party and other factions in southern Lebanon after 2 days of violent clashes claim 11 lives. The fighting in Ain El Hilwa refugee camp near the southern coastal city of Sidon first flared on Sunday after a Fatah commander was killed in an ambush. According to a Lebanese parliamentarian, the sides have also agreed to a probe into the killing and the arrest of all those responsible. The Lebanese Prime Minister has called for an end to the tensions. A ceasefire mediated by Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement failed to end the fighting. Some 400,000 displaced Palestinians live in 12 refugee camps in Lebanon. The camps mainly lie outside the jurisdiction of Lebanese security services. Our correspondent in Lebanon, Mariam Saleh, joined us earlier. She explained Takfiri groups could have been involved in the recent tensions.
And the thing is, there is still a lot of confusion on what exactly triggered this. Of course, it was the ambush against one of the members of Fatah, and he is a very prominent member of Fatah. But whether it was one of the Takfiri groups in the camp that caused this ambush and continue to launch these clashes. That is on one side, but there is also a scenario and a possibility that there is a group within Fatah that is, of course, with the coordination that continues in Palestine between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, and that this difference, and we have also different certain figures in Fatah, and one of them was the one who was al-Mushi, the one that was assassinated. He was against any coordination with Israel. He was with the fact that Fatah move away from any sort of security agreements with Israel, and that there needs to be more support for the resistance. However, you do have some groups and figures that are more close to the fact that there needs to be cooperation with Israel. They are agents of Israel. Whether they are the ones that are being pushed by Israel in order to continue these clashes and create this mayhem in the southern city of Saida, or it is those dormant hubs of the Takfiri groups that are probably pushing for this in order to also paralyze the situation in light of the crisis that Lebanon is living, of course, political, economic, financial, on all levels.
The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for one of the deadliest bombings to hit northwestern Pakistan in recent years. The death toll now stands at 54. Around 200 people were also injured. The suicide attack took place in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province that borders Afghanistan. It targeted an election rally for a pro-Taliban cleric. A regional Daesh affiliate based in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province is a rival of the Afghan Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The Pakistani government has promised to hunt down those behind the terrorist attack. Condemnations and condolences have been pouring in from across the world. Neighboring Iran has slammed the attack as indiscriminate and inhumane. Tehran regards terrorism and extremism as a common security concern for both countries. Our correspondent in Islamabad, Nasser Kazmi, joined us earlier with an update of the deadly Daesh bombing in Pakistan.
Many of the injured who are in the hospitals are said to be in critical conditions, and this death toll may rise further as the authorities fear that the critical injured, many of them, the injured are in critical condition. As the investigation of this blast, the local police chief has claimed that the police has reached a conclusion that this attack was carried out by the Daesh militant group, which is hiding in Afghanistan, and they have recovered a lot of evidences from the blast site so far. And we have seen that Pakistan has been remain in the grip of violence since the Taliban took power in neighboring Afghanistan. And this is the issue which Pakistan has been lifting up with Afghanistan several occasions. So at the moment, the government of Pakistan is looking forward for Afghanistan to come forward and take action against those militants who are said to be hiding in their territory.
The Kremlin has categorically dismissed the possibility of a peace settlement in Ukraine at the current juncture, saying necessary conditions are not in place. The Kremlin spokesman says there can be no peace in Ukraine as long as it is used as a tool in the Western war against Russia. Dmitry Peskov, however, said any attempt to broker peace deserves a positive assessment. He was referring to the upcoming meeting on Ukraine in Saudi Arabia. Peskov said Russia will monitor the meeting, but the objectives and agenda of the talks are not yet fully clear for Moscow. Russia has not been invited to the August meeting in Jeddah, which is set to bring together senior officials from 30 countries. Niger's junta says a former colonial power, France, is plotting to intervene militarily to reinstate the deposed president.
In its search for ways and means to intervene militarily in Niger, France, with the complicity of some Nigerians, held a meeting with the chief of staff of the Nigerian National Guard to obtain the necessary political and military authorization.
French President Emmanuel Macron has vowed immediate and uncompromising action if French citizens or interests are attacked. On Sunday, thousands rallied outside the French embassy to condemn Paris for suspending aid to the Western African country. Some of them tried to enter the compound but were dispersed by tear gas. The protesters also demanded the immediate departure of all Western troops, including those of France. Nigeria's pro-West president, Mohamed Bazoum, has vowed not to resign, even though he has been held for 5 days following a coup toppling his government. The junta has also arrested the president of the former ruling party, as well as oil and mining ministers. Niger is the latest nation in Africa's Sahel region to face a coup. The country's military top brass seized power last week. Many across the West African nation have denounced the coup, while others have supported what they call an end to the era of colonial powers there.
Niger and yet another coup across the African continent. It was on Wednesday when the coup, headed by the country's presidential guard, began unfolding. Soldiers belonging to the guards detained President Mohamed Bazoum and blocked access to his residence in the capital, Niamey. The president's office initially said the guards were unsuccessful in getting support from the National Armed Forces. But shortly after, the army led by General Abdelrahman Tiani expressed support for the coup and said its priority was to avoid destabilizing the country. The military takeover was met with mixed reactions inside of Niger, with the African nation turning into scenes of utter chaos. Bazoum's supporters held a protest rally outside the National Assembly in Niamey, calling for his release. But pro-coup protesters who saw things differently set fire to ruling party headquarters in the capital. They burned French flags and stoned its mission, echoing a growing wave of resentment towards former colonial power France and its influence in the Sahel region. Images showed fires at the embassy wall and people being loaded into ambulances with injuries. The ralliers raised Russian flags and called for the departure of foreign forces.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thank you for listening.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Closer. Iran.
Muharram is the first month of the Islamic calendar. The importance of this month for Shia Muslims is because of the tragedy of Karbala and the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Like all Shia Muslims around the world, Iranian people in all cities observe mourning ceremonies of Muharram month with their own local rituals and traditions in different religious venues to commemorate the courageous martyrdom of their beloved Imam. Today I have come to the city of Zanjan, known as the capital of passion and recognition for Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Zanjan province, located in northwest of Iran, annually attracts hundreds of thousands of mourners from Iran and foreign countries to attend the mourning ceremonies of Great Husseini of Zanjan. The Great Husseini of Zanjan, with a history of more than a century, is one of the religious places of Zanjan, which was built during the Safavid era. Great Husseini of Zanjan is world famous for hosting a large gathering on the 8th day of Muharram, known as the Day of Al-Abbas, which is specifically allocated to Abbas ibn Ali, whose martyrdom was the symbol of loyalty in the Battle of Karbala. Regarding the fact that helping the poor is a must in Islam, annually thousands of animals, including camels, cows, and sheep, are slaughtered and donated by the mourners to the Husseini of Zanjan for making food. I am now in one of the oldest neighborhoods of the city of Zanjan, known as Qumli. Here, Ta'ziyeh Passion Play is being performed, reenacting the Battle of Karbala and the suffering of Imam Hussein and his companions by the hands of the enemy forces. huge crowd of mourners have gathered here. Oh, you can't believe how many people have come out. And let me see. A few blocks away, mourners are beating on their chests. You know, chest beating is the most common mourning ritual among Shia Muslims, which shows their grief and sadness for loss of a dear person. There is love for Hussein wherever you look. On my way to the great Husseiniyye of Zanjan, all the mosques, tekkiyes, and Husseiniyyes were brimmed over with lovers of Imam Hussein who were mourning in their own way. The streets and alleys are all clad in black as a sign of grief for Imam Hussein. Look, it's the great Husseiniyye of Zanjan, a prominent religious site. The greatest mourning ceremonies are held in here. The grandeur of the presence of hundreds of thousands of people here is so great. I was wondering that the love for Imam Hussein never dies. It's like a fire in the heart of all freedom-seeking people, which burns forever. Ceremonies in Iran more than often include food offerings, whether they are held at public venues like mosques or private residences. During Muharram, every village, township or city is abuzz with preparation for votive food that is offered by benefactors and ordinary people.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Food for thought.
And let us listen to a wonderful piece of advice from Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, the fourth infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Seek God's forgiveness and repent to Him, for He accepts the repentance, pardons the evil doings, and knows well whatever you do.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, being patient with children who are toddlers. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service, dear friends. In today's episode, we are talking about being patient with children who are toddlers. Now, patience, of course, is something which we have defined in our programs here on A to Z when it comes to an Islamic lifestyle, because being patient is part of an Islamic lifestyle. Now, this kind of being patience, we have defined it as well. It is more of a determination, a steadfastness, this resilience and perseverance to keep on doing what is right and to keep on walking on the path of Islam and to keep on living an Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, having children, as we have said, is one of the ultimate purposes of getting married. Now, we kind of talked a little bit in previous programs about how, you know, there is a phase of children, which is the infant phase. We kind of want to talk about a little bit, about the toddler phase. So, of course, this is when children, even though toddler is not really considered when they're crawling, but we're going to add that phase in there, right? The crawling and just starting to walk and kind of, you know, standing on their tippy toes and, you know, pulling stuff off from, you know, the desk or the drawer, breaking things in this process. So we really need to be patient in this phase, right? Alhamdulillah, if we were able to pass the infant phase where children have a tendency to cry a lot and cry at very odd times, such as the middle of the night or very, very early in the morning, sometimes before Fajr, which itself is interesting. But we get to the toddler age, you know, in the toddler age, we are definitely going to have to be patient. Welcome back. This is A2Z on IRIB English Radio. So, friends, we are talking about being patient with children who are toddlers. Now, again, we have said in previous programs that one of the pivotal and most important things to do is to have a perspective, which is the perspective of an Islamic lifestyle, not a secular, you know, non-religious kind of perspective, because that will just make things worse. And rather than giving us more patience, it will take away our patience, because mentally we are not in sync with an Islamic lifestyle and with the divine ordainments and ordinances and laws and a prescription of the Almighty Allah. So anyways, one of the things that, you know, we kind of have to realize is that, well, listen, in the crawling phase, right, they're going to put everything in their mouth, right? This is how they kind of learn and they discover and experience these kind of things. On the other hand, they're going to, in the toddler phase when they start walking, well, not only are they going to fall down, but they're going to bring down things with them as well. They're going to pull on things, they're going to pull the tablecloth, which is going to result in things breaking, right? This is all part of the natural process of a child's growth and development, right? And so once we realize, listen, this is normal for the child to do this, right? So this automatically will give us a sense and a source of patience, right? And we also kind of need to think about that we went through these stages as well. And our parents were patient with us as well. God bless them for all of their efforts in raising us. And so, you know, we kind of realize, listen, this is normal, it's okay. We as a parent have to make certain changes in our life so that the toddler is at ease. Instead of us making the toddler making changes in their two-year-old life in order, you know, for us to live at ease, right? No. You know, take things off the table, you know, stop putting the tablecloth on there, and kind of get used to walking around the toddler and kind of, you know, being mindful of what they do and being careful and protecting them. And kind of enjoy this phase of your child's life. And again, it will pass. And there are many sources out there which you can read up on to tell you what else to do when it comes to being patient. But we humbly put just a few at your service. This is an Islamic lifestyle that we want to implement in our lives.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The Dream of Return, Part 1.
The Wailing Wall, or the Western Wall of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Thank you. Shalom. Thank you. I also know that I've come to Israel on the eve of a sacred holiday, celebration of Passover. And that is where I would like to begin today. Just a few days from now, Jews here in Israel and around the world will sit with family and friends at the Seder table and celebrate with songs, wine, and symbolic foods at the center of Passover that makes this time of year so powerful. It's a story of centuries of slavery and years of wandering in the desert. A story of perseverance amidst persecution and faith in God and the Torah. It's a story about finding freedom in your own land. And for the Jewish people, this story is central to who you've become. But it's also a story that holds within it the universal human experience, with all of its suffering, but also all of its salvation. Jewish people sustained their unique identity and traditions, as well as a longing to return home. And while Jews achieved extraordinary success in many parts of the world, the dream of true freedom finally found its full expression in the Zionist idea, to be a free people in your homeland. That's why I believe that Israel is rooted not just in history and tradition, but also in a simple and profound idea. The idea that people deserve to be free in a land of their own. Over the last 65 years, when Israel has been at its best, Israelis have demonstrated that responsibility does not end when you reach the promised land. It only begins.
Danny, you talked a great deal in part one about the narrative and the rights and it all being about rights. By what right? Because I look at you and you don't meet the classic stereotype in the West of a settler with a skull cap and a machine gun in the arm and a Torah in the other. Don't meet that. You're a secular man, I believe.
Yeah.
On what grounds, then, do you say you have a right to be in the West Bank when the international community says you have no right to be there?
As I said, it is my homeland.
You're from Argentina, I believe.
Yes, but as a Zionist, I believe that every Jew should, of course is entitled, but should live in the land of Israel.
That day they came at 10 o'clock. I was in the school. My grandma was making coffee. One of the settlers come inside and knocked at the door. And ask her, this furniture for who? She said, which furniture? And she come out.
Do you ever feel bad, uncomfortable, guilty even when you see that in order to return, lots of other people had to leave against their will, some of whom are living in refugee camps?
Well, I am not sure they had to leave. They left. The fact that there is another ethnic group there, another national group, that feels dispossessed because of that, is tragic. I don't feel any, you know, remorse or burden on my conscience.
I hate them. I hate them for a reason, because they're making our lives worst life in the world.
They try to say we want to live in peace and coexistence. What to our coexistence? You come to my village, you occupy houses, you bring your security guards, the coexistence you make with your donkey to ride on it.
Are you from Israel? Are you in Israel?
I'm from Palestine.
So in this area here, are there a lot of Israelis and Palestinians living together, Palestinians living together?
First of all, you are talking about the Palestinian area. You are in the Palestinian area here.
This here?
Here you are in the Palestinian area.
Okay.
It's for me, it's like, you know, when you come from the States, just you see Netanyahu is a hero. For us, he's a criminal.
Yeah.
And
If he's going to protect the Jews, he needs to protect you.
No, he doesn't protect me.
He's a criminal.
He's a criminal for me.
You want the same rights as the settlers?
I don't want the same rights as the settlers. I want them to leave my house. This is my house.
Israelis occupied the West Bank that hadn't been occupied after 1967, after a war with three Arab countries. 20 years after the initial raid, Israel won the battle and reached the locations it had in mind based on a strategic plan. But based on international law, occupying the West Bank has been illegal. The Israelis have put many obstacles for the Palestinian movement. They have erected a separation wall and have set up numerous checkpoints in order to limit the Palestinians' presence to pave the way for construction of Israeli settlements. Since then, 300,000 Israelis have been settled in the West Bank. Al-Quds is home to several sacred places like the Dome of the Rock, which is the most famous symbol in this city, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque as the first Qibla of the Muslims in the world. It is one of the contentious issues between the Israelis and Palestinians.
Wanted to disconnect the Jews from Jerusalem and Temple Mount. I represented the connection between the people of Israel and Temple Mount. From the moment he attacked me, the activity has grown and much momentum, and we're just growing and growing, and the interest in Temple Mount by Jews has been increasing daily.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Afrocomhead has said BRICS payment system will replace SWIFT in new non-Western world. Igor Morozov has said the continent will be part of a multipolar world with completely new economic relations. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted the unipolar world is collapsing and a multipolar world is being formed with the participation of Africa, where a newly minted middle class will drive consumer demand in the near future. The head of the Coordinating Committee for Economic Cooperation with African Countries, AFROCOM, Igor Morozov, told RT recently. Last year alone, 19 African countries applied for BRICS membership because they wanted completely new economic relations, Morozov revealed on the sidelines of the Russia-Africa summit. After the US and the EU seized Russia's forex reserves, the world realized that it is not only a political weapon, but an instrument of financial pressure on the external and internal policy of any country and any continent, according to Morozov. The US dollar has been weaponized, which is why nations will gradually move away from using it in trade, and the BRICS payment system will replace the SWIFT financial messaging network in a new non-Western world. He said, African leaders are also concerned about further use of the dollar and euro. In this regard, the number of countries wishing to join BRICS is growing rapidly because this is an alternative payment system that is due to emerge within half a year. BRICS is pushing towards trade in national currencies and has begun efforts to establish a joint payment network to cut off reliance on the Western financial system, particularly the dollar. Russian trade ties with African countries have been strengthening in recent years, and there is more room for growth, including through free trade zones that are actively developing in African countries, Morozov noted. He stated, "We are ready and we will supply annually through humanitarian aid everything that we have in the agro-industrial complex, our tractors, aggregates, mineral fertilizers, and technologies. We've achieved amazing results in 10 years, and we want to share this experience with our African counterparts." He added that Russia would do everything to ensure the African economy has a future with access to innovative technologies. Meanwhile, one of Russia's top bankers has said alternative payment mechanisms will be addressed very soon. Speaking to journalists on the sidelines of the event in St. Petersburg, Andrei Kostin, the CEO of Russia's second largest bank, VTB, has said that the US dollar had been weaponized, which is why nations will gradually move away from using it in trade. Kostin said structural changes are bound to happen. African countries are also acting on this. They have already started to create their own systems of information exchange and settlements in national currencies. This is a promising trend. He concluded a share of trade settlements in alternative currencies will continue to increase. Russia and its trade partners among the developing nations, such as fellow BRICS members Brazil, China, India, and South Africa, have started to switch to alternative currencies in mutual trade after sanctions effectively cut Moscow off from the Western financial system. A growing number of nations have expressed their support of the trend. President Putin revealed earlier this month that over 80% of transactions between Moscow and its largest trading partner Beijing are settled in rubles and yuan. Russia announced plans earlier this month to launch negotiations on the switch to national currencies with countries in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, namely Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. A According to Global Times, South Africa will host the 15th BRICS Summit in its financial hub, Johannesburg, from August 22nd to 24th. The five BRICS countries, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, will discuss establishing sustainable payment mechanisms for mutual trade among key issues to be discussed at the summit. The move comes as more and more developing countries are seeking alternatives to reduce their dependence on the US dollar. Experts said that the dollar, used as a tool for the US to exercise international hegemony, has resulted in great uncertainty for the recovery of the world economy. The BRICS countries, including Russia, have been seeking to shift further from the dollar in mutual trade, with the de-dollarization trend gaining momentum following Western sanctions that cut Russia off from Western financial mechanisms. South Africa's Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Nadeli Pandor, said after the BRICS foreign ministers' meeting on June 1st that the new development bank, NDB, is studying the potential use of alternative currencies to the dollar to ensure that we do not become victim to sanctions, Reuters reported. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Part of that global war manifests itself through numerous outliers, like the US-based conservative think tank known as the Middle East Forum. Its name implies that it's a kind of neutral, unaligned debating society. But a cursory examination of its mission statement reveals a very different picture. One of its aims is to steer US policy toward, and I quote, backing an Israel victory over the Palestinians. So in today's programme, we'll be discussing how the Middle East Forum seeks to exert its influence after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra summarising its methodology.
The Middle East Forum is well known in the US as a core part of what has been dubbed the Islamophobia Network. But it is less known in Europe and the UK. It's a hardline Zionist and anti-Muslim think tank founded by Daniel Pipes in 1990. Pipes is a well-known Islamophobe, described as one of the leading misinformation experts. According to the organization's website, its mission is to promote American interests in the Middle East and to protect Western values from Middle Eastern threats. It's based in Philadelphia, roughly halfway between New York and Washington, D.C. The Middle East Forum is headed by a former employee of the Israeli Ministry of Defense, Greg Roman. The forum relies upon its publication, the Middle East Quarterly, and a network of monitoring programs, including Campus Watch, Islamist Watch, and the League Project, to incubate fears of militant Islam and to monitor the people and organizations whose views contradict Pipes and his friends. The Middle East Forum is at the center of the Islamophobia network in the US, spending millions of dollars since 2001, but also internationally. It has supported all manner of far-right and Islamophobic groups in the EU and UK, including in Switzerland, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Spain, and Greece. For example, it has supported the Swiss-based NGO Monitor, which harasses pro-Palestine activists and human rights groups, including attacking Christian Aid Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Oxfam, and Médecins Sans Frontières. In 2010, NGO Monitor launched a campaign against a Dutch foundation, the ICCO, which was one of the funders of the Electronic Intifada. It has provided financial support to counter-jihad activists facing prosecution and those convicted to facilitate appeals. Dutch Party for Freedom leader Geert Wilders and French anti-Muslim activist